This is A View from the Ditch. I'm William Dalton. Our guest on this episode is Stefano Newlon of Trademark Belfast, an organisation which, among other things, has dealt with incidents of sectarian discrimination in workplaces in Northern Ireland, going back to the early days of the peace process. I spoke to Stefano about the work of Trademark in a previous episode back in March, but this time we spoke about the political situation in Northern Ireland, the crisis in unionism, the border poll debate. This was in the context of last month's riots in Belfast, and more recently, First Minister Arlene Foster's resignation. If you want to write to us, it's aviewfromtheditch@gmail.com, or you can get us on Twitter at AVFTDRadio. So, Stefan, I'm speaking to you, as it happens, on the actual centenary of the creation of Northern Ireland, of partition, and it's falling amid something of a crisis, a political crisis, and scenes last month, riots in Belfast that many feel are the worst in a long time. So I want to ask you, as someone who's worked across communities in the north, if you could tell us about the grievances behind those scenes in Belfast. You know, people have cited, you know, the failure to prosecute anyone associated with the Bobby Storey funeral last summer, and the Northern Ireland Protocol undermining the constitutional position within the United Kingdom. But I wonder what else would you say is going on there?
Well, Paisley always said that he would never forsake the blue skies of Ulster for the grey skies of an Irish Republic. I can tell you today that today in the north it's pissing with rain and grey and miserable and windy, so I'm not sure if that's an auspicious symbol for the celebration of 100 years of this statelet. But in terms of the riots recently you referred to, yeah, there was an awful lot of coverage for that. I think that's more to do with the fact there was nothing else happening at the time, really. So it's post outside of the pandemic stories, it was something new, but they weren't that serious in terms of their scope and their size. There weren't that many people involved. They were relatively well orchestrated. There was paramilitary involvement. The same people who met with the Brandon Lewis a month before, and with the DUP a month before. That level of, I'm not saying there was that level of state collusion in it, but the whole thing was just created for, you know, to make an impact about the border poll and stuff like that. But I mean, there was never any suggestion, as was coming out of Britain in particular Remainiacs in Britain, that, oh my God, look what Brexit's done to Northern Ireland. We're back into the troubles. There's going to be a breakout. And it was, I mean, it's just ridiculous kind of analysis coming from over there. And as quickly as those riots started, you'll notice they stopped. Like, to the point, and some of them, and we were up at them as well, and we were, because they were happening right outside our office, some of them 20, 30 people were involved, as opposed to riots during the Troubles when there were thousands of people involved and there was serious damage done and stuff. So, yeah, it was kind of a symbol of discontent within loyalism, and there is discontent within loyalism, but I don't think it was ever that serious. Its relationship to the Bobby Storey funeral is tenuous, at least. I mean, the Bobby Storey funeral was a mistake by the Shinners. I think they know that now, and they fucked up, you know, but it's just been kept alive for the last year, and it's, you know, there were other COVID-related mass demonstrations that were far worse that no one's talking about, so, but we all know that. But of course, the right-wing press in the South and here and in Britain always pull on that kind of story funeral, but it was kind of irrelevant, you know. There is discontent, however, within, you know, the Protestant section of the working class, within loyalist communities, as there has been since the start of the peace process, but a lot of that's economic and social factors, and some of it cultural as well. But I'm happy to get into that with you as we talk.
Yeah, like one of the slogans you heard from some of those rioters, and they were very, as you say, not a huge number, but they were very small. They were largely kind of very young men or teenagers, really. And one of the slogans you heard from them was that Protestants are second class citizens now. Where do you think that idea comes from, and is it widespread?
Yeah, it was kind of hardwired into the kind of narratives around the peace process that, you know, the Fenians are getting everything, Republicans are getting everything. Look what they got, look what we don't have. And of course, that's patently untrue. And in regards to all the stats, when you look at it, I mean, Nationalists and Republicans are still more likely to be unemployed. They're still more likely to be looking for a public housing. They're still more, all of those stats prove the point that there's still some way to go to catch up between those two communities. But there's no doubt that loyalists feel aggrieved, but that's mainly because of the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is this isn't an orange state anymore. It's not as British as it once was. Now, I would have to say it's still a very British place, you know, in terms of the cultural production, in terms of the radio and the TV and the establishment, in terms of, I mean, there's an MI5 base, massive one in Belfast. Let's not forget the British Army is still in Northern Ireland. So it's hardly Irish to the extent that the Republic is. So I think it's just a loss of that supremacy. I mean, the northern states changed utterly, and it's hard for people to accept that and deal with that. And that's really the backstory to all of this. Now, in terms of the social and economic impact, there's no doubt that Protestant communities have suffered badly over the last 20, 30 years. But that's because of neoliberalism. That's because of deindustrialization. That's because of the loss of heavy industry and good manufacturing jobs. And that's because of, and they give their support to a party that agrees with that particular economic philosophy and policy, and to a state that agrees with that particular economic direction. So they have to look inward sometimes and kind of look at that and take that analysis on board. The problem is that within the Protestant working class, there are that kind of working class progressive voice has almost disappeared. It was there 15 years ago. It was there with Davy Irvine and people like that, and we worked with them a lot. And there was really progressive debates happening. There's really interesting stuff going on back at the just slightly post-peace process, kind of early noughties. That's almost completely gone now, and that's an issue, and that's a problem that we all have to face. And so loyalism once again has kind of parked its car behind the DUP, and it's hoping the DUP is going to lead it somewhere. And I can assure you this, it'll lead the working class Protestants nowhere.
Yeah, I think it's something that people coming from outside Northern Ireland struggle to understand, that the main political representative of that unionist community is this, you know, kind of extremist group, you know, historically and politically homophobic party. Now Arlene Foster has resigned, reportedly because she, partly because she abstained on a vote to ban gay conversion therapy, and the apparent front runner to succeed her is a Young Earth creationist.
It is a hard one because it's more of a it's like a tactical allegiance between the working class and big house unionism, if you like. There's another kind of parallel example of that in the marching season, where you have the Orange Order, which is well established, which is, you know, law and order and pro-British and pro-establishment, and then you have the marching bands, which follow after them. And the marching bands are working class; they're loyalists. There's always trouble related to it. There's always kind of issues around the bands that follow the, but the Orange Order hire and pay for those bands to follow the marches. So that kind of the thing you see happening in the summer during the marching season is kind of like a metaphor for the bigger relationship of cross-class unionism, where you have working class prods handing over, if you like, their political agency to middle class and big house unionism. But that cross-class unity is fracturing and it's breaking apart, and it's not as strong as it once was. And so that's another kind of dynamic that's occurring here in the north. So this latest attempt by unionism to, you know, gather its forces together behind one campaign, i.e., against the protocol and, you know, the separation of the north from the rest of the UK in regards to trade and so on. But it's not really working. It's not cat. I mean, 1985, what Paisley brought 120,000 people into Belfast for against the Anglo-Irish Agreement. There was a demonstration 4 weeks ago by the United Ulster Unionists or some new group, and literally, and I'm using that word correctly here, no one turned up. And the bloke who organised it, you know, he was on the radio and he was like, well, you know, why didn't no one turn up? Because, oh, well, I couldn't make it myself, I was busy. I mean, you know, that's kind of a descriptor nearly of what's happening within unionism. The energy that was there 20 years ago isn't there anymore. And that scares some within unionism even more, I think, than anything else.
Yeah, so there's a sense of fighting a rear guard action, isn't there? And like a recent poll had the DUP, you know, down only 1% ahead of the Alliance Party, and see, but also on the other hand, ceding support to the more hardline TUV.
Yeah, well, that, as I said before, that cross-class unity that unionism is built on, really, that's its foundation. I mean, that's how the state was built. it's fracturing, and it's that it's really the middle class liberal unionism that's kind of walking away from the party. So you've got young working class prods whose family may have been in the orange and in the black and involved, and in the you've got them going to university, looking down south, seeing a fairly socially progressive state, if not economically kind of progressive, and they're looking to Europe and stuff. So they're not part of that old style unionism. So they're walking away, and if and when they vote, they're voting Green, or they're voting Alliance, or they're not voting at all, or they're leaving, going to university in England, not coming back. There's also that kind of dynamic happening here as well. So, yeah, that cross-class unity is gone, I think, within unionism, and it's fractured. And unionism now is in a really parlous state because it only ever existed because it had its own state. And it's kind of losing control of that state, both politically, as you just suggested, and even demographically. And that's another story after the census returns, which we took this year, come out next year, we'll see possibly big shifts in. Now, I know it's not just a numbers game, but it also is a numbers game as well at the same time. So, you know, that, so those two things, it's losing demographically, but to an extent, and it's certainly losing politically. What happens in the next assembly elections is going to be fascinating. So will the election of Poots, probably, as you said, a young earth creationist, a man that thinks the world's 4,000 years old, for fuck's sake. I mean, he believes that, you know, Jesus walked the earth with dinosaurs. Whether he's going to lead the DUP into a new and glorious future, I mean, who believes that? I mean, if anything, if you were a young working class Protestant loyalist or a middle class, you'd leave and you'd vote someone else, or you wouldn't vote at all. So it'd be interesting to see what he does to that point. Someone asked me what it was like, and the only way I could describe it was like unionism's like, it's like they're in a dark room looking for a door for a way out, and they find the door in the dark, and they open the door and they walk through the door, but they find themselves even in an even smaller, darker room. And so that's where Poots is now. So he's looking for a door to a new future. He's going to open it. He's going to walk in it, even to a smaller, darker room. And that's kind of the trajectory, it seems to me, of where unionism is heading, which is nowhere.
Yeah, and of course, one of the contradictions of unionism today is that the loyalty, or the entity to which they're loyal, does not reciprocate that loyalty. Like, it, you often get the impression that members, you know, even conservatives in Britain would be happy to be shot of Northern Ireland. And as I think you mentioned the last time we spoke, that Dominic Cummings said he hopes it falls into the sea. And yet, so, you know, if someone like Poots was to become leader of the DUP, it would. We've seen signs recently of more willingness to undermine the Good Friday Agreement sort of openly by, you know, refusing to participate in the North-South dimension.
Yeah, I mean, that the strategy they seem to be fixed on post Arlene Foster with Poots, and Mervyn Storey, who's a senior Orangeman DUP member, come out this morning and says that they'll be willing to collapse the assembly to get their way. I mean, it's another, if they had 5 guns and 5 feet, they'd shoot themselves in every fucking foot they have. Because what happens if they collapse the assembly? Well, then you're going to get some form of, well, certainly direct rule from London, but also it was London that agreed the protocol. So how do they think they're going to win the battle by handing all of the power? Not that the assembly has much power, but it has some. So they're going to hand all of that back to London, to the same people who negotiated the protocol, with potentially more influence from the Dublin government in the and what goes on up in the north, and with pressures for a border poll and so on. So really strategically in it, but it just shows you where unionism is. It almost literally has no other way out except going from one dark room into another. And just that seems to be its trajectory. The idea that this is some brilliant game plan is just like, I mean, unionism has never had a game plan. The only game plan they had was their own state and the majority. That was it. And they've lost, they're losing those, you know, and they don't really know, and there's no other strategy for them. What else do? They had 20 years to try and develop a new kind of civic unionism where they could share Northern Ireland, where, you know, the Irish language would have had its place, Irish cultural traditions, where that identity could have been reflected in within this part of the United Kingdom. And they absolutely and utterly failed to do that. And they refused to do that. And they've had 20 years. So the game's up. They had their chance. And I think now that, as I said before, I think it's, you know, Sisyphus pushing that rock up to the top of the mountain. So this time we might get there. And once it gets there and it just tips over the edge, then you'll see things move quite quickly, potentially, towards some sort of, certainly the discussion will move quickly, whether changes to the constitutional arrangements will follow as quickly. But it's just, you know, the biggest conversation in Ireland at the moment is the border poll and a future United Ireland. It's happening. It's everywhere. You see it everywhere. Whereas 5 years ago, no one spoke about it.
Hmm. Yes, the discussions are happening, and yet there's still, you know, both in Westminster, but also in the south of Ireland, in the major political parties and in the media, quite a dismissive attitude to a border poll, and a suggestion that it would be divisive. That's the word that is always used, and that, you know, it would only exacerbate tensions, and you would see more scenes like we saw in Belfast last month. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I mean, you could argue the existence of the Northern State is fairly divisive, and the last 100 years history has shown us that. You know what I mean? As Connolly says, it's created a carnival of reaction. What happens next is just the same part of that carnival of reaction. The idea that you can just stop Northern Ireland and hold it in some sort of frozen status quo is a ridiculous idea. I mean, they tried that. It was called the 1950s and 60s, and look what happened then. It burst out. It blew out. So the more you try and control this place, and the more you try and kind of wrap it up and tie it up, if you like, and the Southern establishment and the British establishment, yes, you're right, they're going, oh, please, just stop. Just stop where you are, say nothing, do nothing, go. That isn't going to happen. I mean, change is absolutely inevitable anywhere, and it's inevitable here. So the sooner they simply start to engage as grown-ups in the conversation, the better. I've no doubt the Southern establishment don't want anything to do with the six counties, and they'll be forced to by popular pressure, and by perhaps the rise of Sinn Féin, and whether, depending on how well Sinn Féin does in the next elections for the Dáil. But yeah, it's happening, basically. I mean, this place is changing, and it's changing rapidly, and nothing's going to stop that. So really, the message is engage in the debate.
Sure. Will you say popular pressure? Do you see that popular pressure you're talking about, north and south?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, island-wide, and in Britain as well. I mean, I don't think there are that many people in Britain who would, you know, lay themselves down and I'll go over the top, if you like, for the preservation of the link between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. I think they'd be quite happy to cut that link. It all depends, I suppose, on what Europe says as well, and what the Yanks say, and also says, and what capital says. I mean, when the unionist kind of capitalist class, or people with money in the business community in the North start to veer towards, actually, maybe we can talk about getting rid of that border, maybe we can talk about new constitutional arrangements, then you'll see a big shift, I think. And I think they're quite close to that.
You think so?
I think so, yeah. I think everyone's moving in that direction. I mean, there's a mate of mine who's passed away now, Joe Law, who's a member of the Communist Party for years, but he was from the Shankill Road. He was a Protestant on the Shankill Road. He said, I remember we were doing a mediation session once with a load of loyalist lads, UVF ones, and a lot of them are in the band culture. And he says, if all we've got, he said, is bands and fucking bonfires, he says, we're fucked. And he was kind of right about that. That culture war about British expression, about bonfires, about marching, if that's all there is to represent working class political culture, then they are fucked. And it's trying to engage with them and pull them to more progressive positions that we need to be engaged in, having those kinds of conversations, you know. He called them unfairly, Joe. He said unionism was the bastard son of a dead empire. And, you know, that kind of refers to the point you were making, that people in Britain, when they look at Northern Ireland and look at that Britishness, they don't recognise it.
No.
Britishness in Britain, particularly in England, is diverse, it's multicoloured, it's Asian, it's black, it's white, it's a real different kind of modern concept of Britishness. And that one in Northern Ireland is kind of it's like a relic from the past. You know, it doesn't make sense to people who see it, and they don't get it. And the harder they try to hold on to that sense of Britishness, the more alien it looks to Britain. So that's weird. I mean, it's Northern Ireland is a product of a settler state. It's a kind of settler colonial product of colonialism, and we can't get away from that fact. And it just looks weird to British people. They don't get it. A lot of people here don't get it either. But
no,
the big thing, I think, is going to be what that conversation looks like. And all, because there's a real assumption in the South sometimes, I think, from Republicans, who think that the six counties is just going to be swallowed up into a 32-county we free state. And you don't think a million projects are going to go, hold on, what about that flag? I don't like that anthem very much. I don't, you know, that it might fundamentally affect the whole nature of the Republic of Ireland, including a new constitution. I mean, it will change fundamentally the nature of Ireland. So that's a bit that I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
Sure, there'll be some resistance to that, I'm sure.
Yeah, likewise. And I think that's an awkward
look at one. Sorry to interrupt you there, but look at the reactions. Now, I fucking hate it, but look at the reaction to that rugby anthem. I mean, yeah. It's constant, isn't it? People are constantly going on about it. I don't give a shit about rugby. I don't really follow it. But whenever you look on Twitter or Facebook, whenever Ireland play, they're always going on about that new, the Ireland's Call, that's the name of it.
Yeah.
And you think that's a big deal in terms of the changes to the Irish state. Wait till you fucking see United Ireland with a million prods coming into the state. You'll see a lot bigger changes than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we chatted a little bit about some of those questions last week on the show, and like there's one proposal in relation to that by Fine Gael TD, is that our Ireland should join the Commonwealth.
Yeah, and
but what do you think, what kind of compromises do you see? Would you be looking at some kind of consociational model where there's a unionist voice in cabinet?
Well, you could have that. You could have that. Who knows what it will look like, to be honest with you. I mean, there are so many different ways you could take this. I mean, you can have Northern Ireland continuing to exist within a federated, independent Ireland, you know, that the border could stay and that the regional parliament could stay. So there's all sorts of different arrangements you could come up with, I suppose, that would, you know, I suppose, be some sort of compromise to the union's population. But that's the stuff that's going to be interesting, because, I mean, the whole 50% plus one thing, I remember we were doing, another mediation between a group of, well, UVF and a group of Republicans in Derry, and the Derry lad, one of the lads said, he was a former provisional, he says to the UVF boy, he says, what if we get to 50% plus one? What are you going to do then? And the UVF boy goes, we'll just shoot one of you. But you know, it has to be an agreed move forward. It can't just be a simple border poll with literally 50% plus one, because whilst that's okay, and I don't disagree with that in terms of the democratic nature of it, you have to have an agreed move future. You can't force people into a new situation without their agreement or without that discussion, and that'll take some time, I'd say.
Well, indeed. Well, given that the current government of Westminster is totally unwilling to discuss it, and you know, the Northern Ireland Secretary Brandon Lewis and his predecessors have refused to set out the criteria for a border poll to take place. So they're not willing to have a discussion.
Yeah, I never understood that. I must have asked someone why during the negotiations for the Good Friday Agreement, Sinn Féin agreed, or I don't know if they agreed, but it was left in the gift of the British government to call a border poll. I mean, that's a huge blunder, isn't it, strategically? There should have been some sort of threshold that had to be met, I suppose, that triggered certain things to begin the discussion, as opposed to it being totally up to the Brits to say yes or no to that.
Yeah, I suppose the idea might be that it's British sovereignty until it's transferred.
So, well, they've let go of some of their sovereignty, haven't they, with this protocol? So, I mean, that might be an indication they should start considering it. But you're right, who knows who'll call it, when it'll be called. But I don't think the conversation's going away anytime soon.
So you don't expect there to be mass loyalist resistance to that, to the extent that there was in the past?
It could happen, but there's no signs of it at the moment, I don't think. I mean, demographically, there are numbers of people who are unionists, who are born into Protestant British backgrounds, who, you know, are talking about and considering what it might look like, what new constitutional arrangements. That's different from 10 years ago. That debate simply wasn't happening. There may well be resistance. The idea that it will kind of break down into or transform itself into violence, again, I don't think that's going to happen. There's a myth going around that somehow the British government was some sort of referee here between two warring ethnic tribes and wasn't itself heavily involved in the conflict. Organised loyalist violence was organised because of its assistance from the British state. Let's not forget that. I mean, collusion's not an illusion. There's enough evidence out there to tell us that. So whether it really depends on what the role and the attitude of the British state is. I mean, if the British state decides, right, we're going to let go of it, then that'll happen. And that will begin the process. So I'm sure there are conversations happening within those circles at the moment about how you get rid of this place, potentially. Who knows? But then up to the Irish establishment, but like, we don't really want it, thanks. You know, who knows what they're thinking?
And I suppose then, maybe finally, are you optimistic about the possibility of a constitutional arrangement that can accommodate these, you know, often deprived loyalist communities and
the aspirations of Irish
nationalists?
Well,
it's not just constitutional, is it? I mean, that's the whole point. You come up with a really sophisticated new constitutional arrangement which speaks to those various cultural issues and identity issues, but then you've got the issue of you know, mass unemployment and, you know, educational underattainment and all those issues which are really important here. So a 32-county neoliberal Ireland doesn't interest me in the slightest, frankly, even if it does have a new constitutional arrangement. And that's a problem for all of us. So yeah, a new Ireland would have to be one where social and economic issues were addressed directly. In Ireland's current trajectory, in Ireland's current economic structure, this kind of small state open to FDI, you know, lots of people working in gig economies, low wages, that would have to fundamentally change, you know. And I don't see that happening anytime soon, because the establishment, that's the model the establishment wants, and it wants to keep. I mean, housing in the south. I saw a thing this morning. some estate somewhere, 170 new houses has just been bought up by a vulture fund. You know, 170 brand new, and that's the trajectory. Why would anyone want to be part of that state when that's happening? So the left in the Free State has to up its game, doesn't it?
Indeed.
To convince people up here, actually, things might be better in United Ireland, because at the moment, you couldn't argue that. In fact, with unionism coming into United Ireland, it would be, you know, you could have a permanent right-wing government.
Yes.
That DUP and Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, couldn't you? That'd be fun.
Yes, and then, the other thing that often unionists are able to rely on is, you know, of course, is the NHS.
Well, yeah, we keep banging on about the NHS, and it's right. It is a great creation, but it's also being, you know, being privatised, salami slice like over the last 10 or 15 years, and that's continuing apace. So, how long that survives is another interesting feature. But yeah, if you're going to have it, everyone keeps shouting that one. But you'd have to. Ireland should have. I mean, Sláinte Care has been there for how long now? This great aspirational idea of Sláinte Care, but sure, nothing's moved on it, and it's unlikely to. But the idea that modern liberal capitalist state doesn't have a national health system is kind of laughable at this stage, isn't it? But nothing embarrasses the Irish establishment. I mean, you know, the fucking brass necks, unbelievable. I know. So the fact that people can't buy a house or buy a flat or get a, you know, public housing doesn't embarrass them. So why would not having a health system? But it is one of the big. It would be one of the big demands, I suppose, in those negotiations. But there are so many others. And those negotiations would be torturous, wouldn't they? And they'd be lengthy, I imagine.
Yeah, that's for sure. But is it your view that we are moving towards a united Ireland, whether or not those kind of material concerns are addressed?
I always thought post Good Friday Agreement and the organisation I work for, Trademark, we always had this kind of analysis that post GFA, Northern Ireland had reached its zenith. That was it. It wasn't going to do anything else. And they would try and hold it together as long as they could. And that things would only change here if there was some sort of exogenous shock, bang, from the outside. If the world changed outside, Northern Ireland would be forced to change along with it. And that was Brexit, and that was the Brexit vote. That was the exogenous shock that came in and just threw everything up in the air, and now we're watching where things fall. And where things are falling is slightly towards that move towards new constitutional arrangements, as opposed to moving in another direction, which is solidifying the union. So that's all I would say on that, is that it's quite clear that the direction of travel is in that direction. What happens or where it goes, who knows, like, you know, and it'll be an interesting. And of course, we're having this debate about this tiny little place on this tiny little island on the edge of Western Europe whilst the world burns. So other exogenous shocks might hit in the next 10 or 15 years that we really become concerned about, like food security and water security and climate breakdown, which might put all of this on the back, you know, into the halfway place, as you would say.
Indeed. Well, on that note, Stefan, thanks a million for talking to me today.
Five B, Goran Maggot.
That's it for this episode of A View from the Ditch. Thanks to our guest, Stefan O'Nulon, and to Natalie Nikasija and Irla O'Donnell, as always, for our theme music. Our email address is aviewfromtheditch@gmail.com.